Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Room 42. I'm Liz Fraley, this from Single Sourcing Solutions, and I'm your moderator. This is Janice Summers, our interviewer, and welcome to Sweta Venya. Today's guest in Room 42.
So excited.
Sweta is
Yay.
Let me do a little, let me at least tell folks all about you. She's an assistant professor of rhetoric, professional and technical writing at Virginia Tech University in Blacksburg, Virginia. Her scholarship centers around the ever-evolving, changing, and challenging global issue of natural and man-made disasters like earthquakes and climate change. And she draws upon non-Western paradigms into dialogue with contemporary rhetorical framings of these disasters to support local and global communities facing these kinds of events. She's working on a book project now. It's very, gosh, I love the title, Social Justice Oriented Technical Communication in Global Disaster Management, to demonstrate how local knowledge and transcultural practices of recognizing, highlighting, and valuing marginalized perspectives during or after crisis can create opportunities for tackling social injustices in post-disaster situations. It's a lot of work, that's a mouthful.
Mouthful.
But it's gonna be, it's fertile ground for us to talk today and start answering the question and how content practitioners can help with disaster response. Welcome, Sweta.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's so nice to have you here. So Sweta, I'm curious, what started you on this path for your focus? What inspired you?
Well, thank you so much for that question. I have to go back to all the way to 2015, when I'm originally from Nepal. I was born in Kathmandu and raised there. So in 2015, we suffered through a huge earthquake. Actually, there were two earthquakes that came in between April 25th and May, and a lot of aftershocks. And during that time, I was already working as a journalist as well as communication practitioner.
Okay.
So my role as a journalist was with Nepal's national radio called Radio Nepal. And I was there, English news reader as well as editor. Uh-huh. And so right after earthquake hit, the first thing I did was went to my office and read news about how many people were suffering through, how many people were dying. And, you know, and in my other job, which was with a small nonprofit organization, I had to start just like immediately create various contents about and awaring people about like what's going on and like addressing audiences.
You had to disseminate all of the information that was coming to you as a journalist, and then you had to then take that and translate that into consumable content for people who are experiencing.
Yeah, those were two different jobs at two different institutions, but one job informed the other, obviously.
Right. Okay, so go on.
Yeah, so after that, again, so PSU was always a plan for me, but I think earthquake brought this huge, you know, I wouldn't say enlightenment, but it forced me to think about the ways I have communicated for the past 8 years, and how did I communicate during the earthquake and post-earthquake. So right. After the earthquake, So I was working with one specific nonprofit, but then I changed my job to work in an international nonprofit.
Okay.
So for that, I needed to interview people whom we were supporting via a lot of like billions of money received from European Union. So I was interviewing people who were direct beneficiaries, and uh-huh. I was asking them questions to impress the donors and to, you know, to kind of like to hear what I wanted to listen. And then I wrote one blog post. It was about a woman. It was not like the interview was not false, but it was mostly like I was asking her a question that I wanted to hear.
Okay.
So when I wrote and published that article, there were 400,000 views and 25,000 responses from
wow.
all over the world.
Wow.
But that
sparked
really
some interest.
Made me, yeah, it was, but that really made me contemplate a lot on, did I do this right? Did I do, I mean, you know, like a lot of like self-reflection on that. So I think when I came to get my PhD here, I couldn't let that go. One, my roles as communication practitioners at two different venues and the way I communicated. But one thing I need to mention that I never received a degree in communications or technical communication back home. It was English and it was all learning by doing.
Right.
So I had no experiences of like, I knew like journalism ethics, but for organizations, organizational communication, it was mostly like what my boss wanted me to do. It was mostly like what my boss wanted me to do and, you know, and like what the donor wants to hear.
Right. So it was more of a, you took on more, because you were learning as you were going, it puts you in more of a position of just taking guidance from other people rather than having that guidance in yourself. Right. Because you were just getting started and you were finding your way as you were going.
Yep. And I was just doing my job.
Right.
Well, right.
Because so many people do.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, and the other part of me was I use a lot of social media back home and I still do. And I saw a lot of people and friends and like, you know, like my friends back home using Twitter to kind of respond to disaster in a way that nobody has ever seen. So it was like Twitter became this platform for a lot of Nepali advocates and activists who work together to reach out to like authorities to kind of like, you know, question them and to, you know, to actually do the work. So it also created a situation of where a lot of international actors would participate in responding to disaster in Nepal via Twitter. So it created that. I experienced that myself. And so I brought that all together with me, and that's how it set my path. Yeah. It was a long answer to a very short question.
No, it's a good answer because you know, there's so much richness in the background, right? In knowing the roots of something, right? People can read research and they can read, you know, books, but having that candid conversation about what really inspired you and what influenced you, I think it adds a lot of richness to it. And understanding the backstory, for me, I always find it very interesting and enlightening because it does inform your future. Like all of those experiences informed your future. So you took all of that and then you decided you wanted to go deeper, right? And expand. So tell us a little bit more about what your next step was. Like you have all of this backstory and then that influenced you to look at how we ask questions, how we disseminate information. Tell me more about that.
So after coming here, that question was always there. And I think I really wanted to explore the ways communications can be enhanced and the use of technologies could be enhanced in such situation.
Right.
So, yeah, as I was exploring that and just like being a graduate student, you know, like just exploring, and I have this idea of like, I want to study something about Nepal and something about Nepal earthquake. But it was a very nascent idea until my second year. But in my second year in 2017, Puerto Rico underwent through a massive hurricane.
Yes.
So since I was already interested in disaster, I was observing, reading, and again, seeing a lot of activism that was happening on Twitter. And similarly, there was a Mexico earthquake as well. So all these three disasters that happened one after another in various like marginalized spaces.
Yeah.
And how people actually responded to that without trusting the authorities, without, you know, like, and complaining a lot about them, but like actually doing the work, it really inspired me to think deeper about how various communities create their own networked actions and how do they support their communities? What are their practices in terms of knowledge making about disaster, actual disaster response, as well as how do they manage it, right? And also the major question was, how do they perform all these activities transnationally? So it's not just that they are working together with them, but they are working with people around the globe, be it diaspora, be it people who really love Nepal or have worked in Nepal or visited Nepal in some ways. So are insane in the case of Puerto Rico, people, diaspora that's in the US or diaspora around the world. So it felt to me like in around the world, there are various global communities that even their origin country would be somewhere else, but they are spread around the globe. So that's how I kind of like noticed that when disaster happens locally, it's not just a local event, but it's a global.
Yeah, it has a global mm-hmm. interest because, you know, yeah. I mean, we're a global community.
Yep. And it's not just in the level of people, but also mm-hmm. level of the government. And, you know, like various international organizations. And again, like there are various levels of those global interactions.
Right.
That happened such that a lot of people around the world responded to Nepal. But in the case of Puerto Rico, it's slightly different because Puerto Rico is still considered part of the U.S. So in U.S. handles that a little bit differently. You know, like Nepal opened its border for a lot of support, but it didn't happen here. So the...
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Yeah. I did not realize that.
Yeah. I was going to ask what patterns you were seeing.
Yeah.
So in terms of what, Nepal or?
Well, just in terms of what you're observing, like what are you starting to see? Differences, similarity, like that was the first one. You're like, yeah, they didn't respond the same way.
Yeah, and yes, the striking similarity is that they reach out to their respective diaspora around the world. And they use social media as well as various platforms like Facebook, Twitter, to actually advocate and bring all these people together. And the difference is like obviously these like this two disaster was completely different, right? Mm-hmm. It was hurricane and it was earthquake. So what I found interesting to me was hurricanes are slightly predictable. Earthquakes are not. So like technically speaking, and also people in Puerto Rico have already faced smaller and bigger, some bigger hurricanes in the past. And they know how to prepare for it, you know, like stock up food. And even though they were prepared, they were not ready for that level of devastating hurricane.
Right.
So they knew that what to do, what happens after a hurricane, but in Nepal, it was not that.
Yeah.
There were like a lot of PSAs in Nepal, like how to do, what happens in the earthquake, you know, like how, you know, like we always knew a big earthquake will come, but there is no early warning system for earthquakes.
There isn't.
We're that way in California, right? So we get that. Hey, make the right now all along the highway there are big billboards. You know, have your pack, and this is what should be in it.
It suddenly hit us, and a lot of the duck cover one. There were a lot of bodies that were found in such a position. Oh, yeah. It's very sad.
It is.
So yeah, the community's practices were slightly different. I think in Nepal, I saw a lot of people use both Facebook and Twitter equally, but in Puerto Rico, the most, because Puerto Rico didn't have electricity and internet for a long time, and they used WhatsApp more as well as Facebook. So those were the two prominent technologies that were used.
I was going to ask, why do you think it was Twitter, and now you're telling me it's not? At least for this one, that's interesting.
Yeah. So Twitter, in the context of Nepal, I think was very. So I think it's the context of the community and how the community used this specific software or technology, right? And how that community has adapted to this certain technology. So in Puerto Rico, it was mostly Facebook because that was the easier way to access information for people. Mm-hmm. In Nepal, it was both. And I saw there were a lot of people, especially very young people who were really using Twitter for purpose of fun and some activism, but earthquake kind of shifted that, and it was so much of activism and it became the tool. And there were also a lot of data visualizations and stuff like that had happened during the earthquake. So these were people who had their other jobs, right? And they were just taking out some time to devote to the community. So that's something that's different as well.
Is that mostly communicators or people who are trained or just anybody who had,
anybody, yep. Neat. So there were people who were who would work in nonprofit, who are engineers, who are, just students in the US, and they had multiple different roles in their in their day job, but they were mostly advocating for the communities and doing a lot of relief work and stuff like that. And same in Puerto Rico as well. So, and there were people a lot of interviews in Puerto Rico where, I just posted on my Facebook that I needed X many tarps, and the tarps arrived from Australia, those kind of international connections. So it was, it made me kind of realize that people are, with these tools that we have, technological tools, people are powerful and people have created various contents that actual content producers and technical communicators now need to pay attention to it, I think.
So the more non-traditional methods of communicating are becoming the more powerful methods for communicating.
Yeah, especially in the case of disaster, I think. Mm-hmm. It's, and we have seen this trend in various, in Arab Spring Rising, Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street and stuff like that. I think the various movements, I think, also motivated a lot of people because we see these world trends going on and we have this platform where we can connect with a lot of people and we can reach out to stakeholders quickly. We can ask questions quickly. We can make them accountable and stuff like that, I think. So it's kind of this citizenry activism space. And as technical communicators, I think listening to that, reading into those specifically in the context of disaster will help us recognize what are the practices, what's going on, right? How is marginalization happening in post-disaster situation? And also like what kind of newer social injustices that's happening? Is somebody getting really more relief in some areas? Right. So in Nepal, there was one specific area where people got a lot of relief materials. And same in the case of Puerto Rico, because some spaces and places were highlighted more than the others, right? So in one example, I remember from food bank in Puerto Rico was there were tons and tons of materials that were in the ships and in the dock. And there were so many like other, there were no truck drivers who could transport food from food bank to other places within the Puerto Rico. But there were so many drivers who were supposed to work with the government, but were engaged in that, but not doing any work because there were a lot of paperwork to fill out. There were a lot, the ships were sitting there doing nothing. So those kind of like social situations also, there a lot of like complex situation arises in post-disaster situation, especially regarding social injustices. So I think as technical communicators, I think we really need to investigate and understand what kinds of social injustices are happening and explore that more and write about it, communicate about it, bring the stakeholders together and amplify the voices of marginalized people in such situation.
Well, and last week we heard from one of your colleagues, actually, Carlos Evia, and he was telling us how one of the things that started him down his path was he assisted with some construction workers who didn't speak English. And so they didn't have access to understanding the forms or dealing with, like, there were a lot of things that were just out of reach, inaccessible, because nobody focused on that or added support for that for everyone. So are you finding similar places where technical communicators can help increase accessibility in situations like in Puerto Rico, right? There's a lot of paperwork. It probably wasn't, it may have been in multiple languages, but it may have been a complex language. Are people looking at that? Is that where we can go and help out? Like, is that where our skills can be useful?
I do think so. I think reaching out, like I said before, finding the spaces and exploring the spaces and potential social injustices can happen is the key. And I think putting public as a key stakeholder in that communication process is also really important. And I think as technical communicators, we also need to understand the position of privileges that we are equipped with, or, you know, like we have ability to write, we have ability to communicate. One specific example that I can give is there were a lot of paperwork to fill out for housing purposes in Puerto Rico, but a lot of this is like kind of off the record, but I think people still know it. A lot of housing there are do not have like papers, or, you know, because that's handed over from one person to another. I don't want to use the word illegal, but
yeah. No, that's formal. It grew up as a colony, stuff has been there.
Yeah. It's less right. formal.
In such cases, it was very difficult for those people to get relief and funding from FEMA because they do not have the paperwork, so they had to go through a different route.
Wow.
In that process. So I think those kind of specific examples are where technical communication caterers can help. In the case of Nepal, I think the other thing that I really think about a lot, as well as I think happens in disaster, is we have some specific technical communication tools and resources, but I think those tools and resources need to be contextualized such in such a way that technical communicators can listen to the voices of people who are actually at the receiving end. Like I said, they should be, public should be the key stakeholders in such communication process. Well, in that, public's culture, background, knowledge also come together. So I think like recognizing that interculture or cross or transculture, whatever we call it, those practices will help a lot, because even in like not just communication purpose, but also like disaster relief and management purpose, because there were a lot of specific example for Nepal, as one of my interviewees had shared, was there were, I cannot remember which government, an international country provided one truck full of sparkling water to send it to a village in a very rural population. And when they opened the bottle, all the people got very scared and disregarded their water because they have never seen sparkling water.
They don't drink sparkling
water. They don't drink sparkling water, right. And it scared them.
It's right? Weird.
So that's a very prime example of how, yes, the motive there is to help. The motive is right. To support people, right? But at people at the receiving end, what kind of support do they need? What kind of does this particular communication, if we think about communication, does this communication material help them to navigate the process or help them to understand
right, like in that that's a good situation.
It is a great example.
This water, which the company was generally sending them mineral rich water, it happened to have effervescence, but there was no communication to the people mm-hmm. who were receiving it to yep. understand what this is. And you can let the carbonation go, just open it, it'll fizz out and it'll go flat if they don't want to drink it fizzy. But without explaining to them,
no awareness of
coming from, it's kind of like a understanding the receiver. It's okay to give the gift, that's wonderful, and to give generously, that's wonderful, but make sure that you've got the communication in place so that the receiver understands from a cultural place what that is, so that they can right. use
and
it appropriately.
Not able to read the labels as well, because
right, no, you
right.
can't
read. Right.
You
can't literacy rate is 66% in Nepal.
Right. So that might be a good information for large companies that want to donate, is be aware of the community that you're donating to. And this is going direct to the people, which is wonderful that it went directly to the people who needed some kind of support. But make sure you've got good technical communications that takes into consideration the community that you're donating to, so that they understand what product or service this is, so that it doesn't upset them and it doesn't cause fear, because they're already in a state of fear, right?
Yeah, I think another thing is one specific cultural approach will never be applicable to all community.
Right.
So I think technical communicators should recognize and understand that and actually implement that. I think they understand that already. But I think actually implementing that and really working with the community, because post-disaster situations are very stressful and high pressure.
Yes.
And in that kind of communication, it will actually save lives of people, right?
Yeah.
Here we are,
right. We're
thinking about life in that situation. So it's a very high pressure environment and stressful in that ways. I know people want to do good and want to help, and you know, but I think that Well, preparing for like future disaster, I think it's really important to understand that when you go to somewhere else, when you go to some other places to help, even as a volunteer, as tech writer or content creator, I think you really need to learn and explore and investigate and work with the community to understand what will be applicable, what's the need of the community during that hour. Is it informational need? Is it material need? Is it like, are there any rumors that need to be, you know, taken right. out? Because there were so many rumors during Nepal earthquake.
That's kind of the downside, right, of the social media, is that's how, you know, a lot of untruths come out, right? And then people think it's true. So being able to communicate and being the voice of truth is important in those times. And you brought up another good point. Are there communications in place for volunteers who show up? Because there's people who volunteer to go help out these communities.
Yeah.
What's the communication like for those people? Are there communications saying, okay, you're stepping into this region. Here's some information about the people that you need to understand, their culture, their way, how they are. Are there things like that are in place?
Maybe those things are now coming into places, but I don't remember those specific guidelines or steps to follow specifically during the earthquake. But I think as we navigated through that, those practices have now become a practice. And I think I really want to highlight this. So World Health Organization recently created this package called Risk Communication Community Engagement. Mm-hmm. So in that, they have, and it's specifically for COVID and specifically related with how, and they coined the word infodemic because there's a lot of like informational crisis ongoing. So they created this nice framework that can be used by people who really want to do risk communication in such an environment.
Now, and I remember when we were talking in prep, you were talking about, and I'm trying to remember quite it all it was, but how in particular women are misserved, if that's the right way to think about it, for disaster communication and relief.
I think misrepresented might be, or not recognized might be a good word. So the thing that I noticed, yes, women and children and old people are the vulnerable category in various spaces, specifically in Nepal and Puerto Rico as well. But there were women, my interviewees, where these brave women who were like communicating, managing, and creating connections and responding to disaster. So kind of they shift this vulnerability rhetoric that's ongoing. And, you know, if you see all these pictures on a big organization's website, you see very vulnerable women carrying children, or lifting heavy weights, you know, and are working in the field. So that's a very like developmental communication.
It's a very specific picture.
And again, like thinking back to when I was communication practitioner, that's kind of like picture that I wanted to use in the communications. To attract the donors to see like, oh, okay, these people are vulnerable, and just, you know, and also like a lot of those pictures would have to display the logos and of the donor. That's a different thing. Anyways, so a lot of time women are represented as being vulnerable, but during these two disasters, I saw a lot of women practitioners kind of having that civic responsibility towards their community, working a lot in communicating, distributing materials, making connections around the world, and having that agency, I call it rhetorical agency, having that agency to serve their community with the resources they have, using their resources they have, and in some cases, creating their own resources as well. And these women were really devoted to the community. Mm-hmm. And in Nepal, I can specifically tell one example that one woman practitioner specifically mobilized the resources that she had to create a radio program that talks about earthquake, but it's not like the expert speaking like, oh, this is what you need to do during earthquake or wash your hands or stuff like that, but in the form of storytelling by the community member. So going to the community and making them talk and making them tell the story. And it was very powerful. And it was distributed via national radio, and it became really popular. And it was very, very short. I think it was like in between 10 minutes or even shorter. So in that short period of time, they would tell a story about how to drink clean water, you know, how to manage stuff during earthquake and what happens, stuff like that. So I think highlighting that kind of like, the example is that she had resources and she had the ways to do that. She could invite any expert around the world, but she went back to the community, brought their stories and distributed via public medium. So those kind of stuff, as well as a lot of women made a lot of transnational connections and used, again, going back to social media, used a lot of platforms, and some even created platforms. In the case of Puerto Rico, there was this application called Connect Relief, and the manager was a woman who kind of like basically she called herself, I was a human robot, because she would connect volunteers to the people who needed help. And she was just continually doing that. But then with the use of applications, she just trained a lot of people one by one, like going to the churches and training them. And the church pastor will train another 10 or 15 people. So it's creating those kind of networks. We saw a lot of that. So I think like a lot of women broke boundaries to help their community in these two disasters.
Interesting. So I think that's really interesting, and it's contrasting to the portrayal, because you talked a little bit about the portrayal of women historically being, you know, somewhat in need, instead of looking at them as powerful sources for networking. So how we can change our communication and our focus to disseminate information to these powerhouses that can then help make change at a very local scale and get their local communities. So you're actually finding that they were movers and shakers on the ground and making things happen versus needing things to be given to them. Right? So that's a complete shift of what other people would think on the outside. So what are some things that you're finding are patterns? Are these patterns that repeat in like all the disaster areas and the marginalized communities that you've looked at?
Can you say that again?
So the pattern of the difference in the fact that, you know, we often see these women being portrayed as being kind of in need, right? So that means you just shove things to them. But in reality, what you were finding in Puerto Rico and in Nepal, and I'm asking if you're finding that in other places, that the other is true. they actually make things happen, and they are powerhouses to create, disseminate information, correct information to their communities, and empower people to come together. Are you finding that in other areas as well, in other communities that you're looking at?
I think specifically in during the current COVID situation, I think I see a lot of these women again doing such kind of practices.
Right.
But since like I just finished my dissertation, which is mostly focused on these two spaces,
right.
I haven't explored the other disaster. But having said that, what I have seen is like a lot of various feminist-based organization and grassroots movement. A lot of women have used their platform for raising awareness about issues of COVID and how it impacts the impacts of COVID in domestic violence or gender-based violence and stuff like that. So I have seen that trend that's going on in various spaces, especially in cases of China as well as in Nepal. And I think that's gonna be my next project on how do women resist, cope, and manage disaster, specifically in the post-COVID era. So that's going to be my next research project.
Cool.
Yeah, because that's an interesting discovery. And how can we change how we serve these communities in times of disaster? Like we just as a general out there global community, how can we improve when places, especially places that are traditionally marginalized, are in the throes of a disaster? How can we better serve?
I think a lot of institutions does have exclusionary practices that exclude certain group of people and certain marginalized people. And during disaster, those who suffer are the most vulnerable and most marginalized, right? So we already know this. And I think within, as technical communicators, within our respective institutions, within our respective workplaces or spaces that we work in, I think we need to explore what are the practices that has been marginalizing the targeted audiences or have marginalized or maybe have slight chance of marginalization in case of disaster, right? And replacing those exclusionary practices with inclusion, I think is important. And it happens in terms of writing, designing documents, producing webinars, inviting women in talks and stuff like that. So one thing also, another thing that's ongoing trend in Nepal is we have seen all these people who organize webinars and everything, they have a lot of what we call manuals, only male speakers. So every time they have like all male speakers as if there is no women to speak on those specific topics. So there is a movement going on to reject manuals in Nepal and specifically feminist activists who are working on that. Sometimes I think it's like people do not recognize women and their contribution in various spaces, right? And that's seen in specifically in public spaces in Nepal. So we have been advocating a lot to making them more inclusive and calling them out and saying like, hey, you are repeating the same thing. So the topic would be gender-based violence against women, and speakers will all be male. So that's just a hypothetical example. So it's just exclusive.
Kind of an obvious one.
Yeah. So, and that has happened. And so it's mostly right. Exclusionary practice. I think as technical communicators, we need to recognize what are those exclusionary practices,
yes.
And replace it with specific steps in of inclusion.
And how people can improve. Because I think technical writers, they have more of a critical eye to things, right? They pay attention to the fine details. Whereas a lot of people, they don't necessarily, you know, we all are like influenced by a society around us, or we just fall into a pattern as a culture. And without those critical eyes that help guide us gently but firmly in a new direction. I mean, and I think that's one of the rare gifts that technical communicators offer, is like they can really look at things from a critical perspective, and the little details that might be missed to, like, you know, some heads of companies, they didn't realize. But if you've got somebody that's taking a look at this and gently and firmly steering them towards inclusionary practices and accessibility and pulling this into every aspect of the company, I think that helps make everybody aware, don't you?
Yeah, I think we do have power to amplify those voices, to research, you know, like to talk and to advocate for people. And I think as technical communicators, that's a gift. Like, as you mentioned, I think we do have that gift, and we also do have civic responsibility,
right,
to intervene and to make change. And I think to be more, to advocate more for people who are suffering.
Right.
And we're particularly glad you could join us.
Thank you.
As someone joked in the chat, if I had a dime for every tech come from Nepal that I had heard on an interview.
They're joking.
They're kidding. Right. We're super glad that you could be here with us.
Yeah, I'm also really glad. Thank you so much for having me here.
Thank you for being on. And everyone, you can connect with her. I put the links in the chat window. You can send her an email. You can connect to her on LinkedIn. See her faculty page. You know, she's easy to talk to, as you can tell, and interested to hear stories. And
thank you.
Thank
you for your work. Thank you.
Change maker. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Thank you again. It's just
delightful. Thank you so much for having me and talking to me and making me rethink about my work and why I started on this path and everything. It was really, really wonderful to be here.
And keep going. I can't wait for your next book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully it'll come out sooner.
All right. Well, yeah. And folks, keep an eye on the event page. When we get the link to the book, we'll put it up there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, feel free to communicate and connect with me on Twitter, Facebook, email, anywhere.
All the communication channels you're tapped into.
Yeah.
She's there.
Are you on Discord yet?
All right, everyone. Thanks for coming, and we'll see you next time.
All right. Bye.